And thank you all for coming. It's certainly been such a nice treat to get a chance to do this for the last 3 weeks with you all. So I have some more things for you that I'll tell you about at the end of the session. But first of all, paradise. It's the third part of Dante's Divine Comedy. It's probably the part of the story that gets, interestingly, most often neglected. And there's been lots of sort of theories about that over the years. But you can sort of project for yourself, you know, maybe we're a little more comfortable with familiar hells than strange heavens. But Dante wrote Paradiso, finished it just before he died in 1321. And what people need to learn, I think, people that are going to try to dive into Dante, just like we talked about on the first day, Dante's story continues, even through paradise. So one shouldn't be daunted by the challenge, because, you know, you don't want to settle for cheap grace, I guess, right? You know, you want to sort of embrace costly grace. So what Barbara Reynolds, who was Dorothy Sayers' best friend, in her introduction to Paradise, said the following thing. And she sort of reconfigured a quotation from C.S. Lewis's A Great Divorce. And she says the following thing. The joys of heaven in our present condition are an acquired taste. And Dante's Paradiso is about the acquisition of that taste. So that's what you're sort of trying to cultivate. You're trying to cultivate a kind of culinary theological appetite, I guess, when you're reading Dante's Paradiso. And if you ever, you know, try to get your way to it, hang in there for the first two cantos. Don't get psyched out, because I think what happens is people get to canto two and they freak out, and I'll explain why in a second. And then they kind of stop, and they rob themselves of a shot at what we sort of been calling a shot at the big light. So let me just give you first, initially, an anecdote that we talk about anecdote as antidotes, right? Stories that heal. And I've been sort of amazed because we've been fortunate enough over the years to have a people with a Southern accent be sources of grace. And I noticed it here the last 3 weeks, and it's been really cool because I have a very, very, very dear friend, Mr. Milton Burke, who lives in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and he's taught Dante at Fayetteville High School for many, many years. And when I met him at a Dante seminar at the University of Vermont in 1990, and I got introduced to his Southern accent for the first time, and it was just such a delight because every word is sort of stretched, you know? I mean, and so it's like every sentence takes, you know, a week and a half or so. And it's fabulous because you just get to sort of, you know, be with that voice, you know, is a wonderful thing. And Mr. Burke and I, for about 15 years, once a year, my college advisor said a history of literature is a story of one grand conversation. And in honor of that, Mr. Burke and I, after we became friends, and we're still friends, we talk on the phone often, play golf together often, too, and golf's a great game to talk Dante while searching for lost balls, because you have, certainly in my case, I have lots of time to do that, and often. But Mr. Burke and I hooked up our classes on a phone interview every year. So we would find a Dante scholar somewhere in the world, and we would call them and hook them up. And we had a chance to talk, I think, about 15 Dante people. Alan Mandelbaum, a translator of the Divine Comedy, we talked to him with his illustrator on the phone. And so they had a chance to talk to two high school classes in the United States at the same time, and we would pass questions back and forth. And so we were lucky enough to talk to a couple of people in Germany about Salvador Dali's illustrations, and it was just a blast and fun to share it with him. And now he's retired, so we don't get to do that anymore. But he told me the following anecdote, and it introduces paradise perfectly. He and his wife have two children, Marshall and Massey. And I met them when they were little kids, and now they're not anymore. They've grown into fine young. Mr. Burke now has two grandbabies, he calls them, two little girls who are now three. They live in California. And he told me the following story. He said when their first child, Massey, was born, the first thing he did, when he got out of the car, he took his baby, his first child, into his arms, and he, you know, no crib, no bags, no nothing, walked into his house in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and he laid down on the floor, and he put her to his chest, and he played the following piece of music for her. Sorry. Day one in her home. And I asked him why. And he looked at me with this, he's got a really big red beard. And he looked at me and said, because I wanted our daughter to know from the first day in her home that there was order to the universe. And I just, you know, have been so grateful. I've been to get to have friends like that, you know, on some level. And Dante, the pilgrim, is still in Purgatorio at the beginning of paradise. It's nice that they kind of segue. And then he tells us he's going to try to tell us as much about his experience of heaven as possible, but he can't remember much of it. Of course, he does a pretty good job with it. But he says he doesn't remember much, but he's going to tell you and sing about it as best he can. And he's not sure just exactly how this is all working, right? Because he hasn't acquired the taste of paradise either. He's an infant. You know, he gets to the top of Mount Purgatory and he starts off as a child. In fact, Beatrice even points out and says that she looked at him like a raving child because he didn't understand where he was going, how it was working. And it turns out that what she has to explain to him finally when, he starts to understand, she says that there's an order to the universe and that he's flying home. He's on his way to wholeness. And that's, you should not be more surprised that you're on the way to wholeness than you should be surprised that a river flows downhill. So early on, right at the beginning, the pilgrim is mystified. She looks at him, kind of shakes her head and just, you know, oh my goodness. You know, here I have this, you know, 35-year-old, 4-year-old that I'm going to have to kind of walk through paradise, you know, because Dante, you know, begins like all of us, you know, get to that next step where you realize that you have to kind of start over again. So when you get to Canto 2, here's what happens. In the Ptolemaic universe, the Earth is at the center of the universe, and it is surrounded by 10 spheres. Right? And that's a really, science has sort of gone past the facts of that, but our Dante class talk last night, which I'll tell you a little bit about at the end, that the truth of it still is really meaningful, you know, the power circles. And so the allegorical structure of the Ptolemaic universe is very conducive to growth, even if science has said no to it. You know, it's like our hearts and spirits sort of need to say yes to it. And the first sphere is the sphere of the moon. And Dante goes along with Beatrice. They fly up as fast as a bolt that's shot from an arrow is shot. But Dante describes it in reverse. He went as fast as the arrow hitting the target going backwards, because that's how fast he was going. And he's full of gratitude, and he gets to the moon. And when he's at the moon, this is not a NASA experience, because he doesn't land on the moon. He enters the moon, just like every sphere that he and Beatrice enter it, and he doesn't cause a splash, right? Like the principle of displacement in paradise doesn't carry a whole lot of juice. Because like love at its best, you can be one with something else or someone else and still maintain the integrity of both. Does that make sense? So he's in the moon. It's a really cool thing. He enters it like a beam of light enters a drop of water. So it's beautiful, he described, and he's there. And he doesn't understand why there are spots on the moon. And so Beatrice says, she sets him up. She's somewhat of a sinister pedagogue in paradise, because she asks him some questions that she knows he can't answer. And then he articulates it, and she catches him in the act of being clueless. And then she educates him. So old school, I guess, right? But she says, so tell me what you think causes the spots on the moon. You know, let's have a conversation. And he says, I think it's caused by density and rarity. And she says, you couldn't be more wrong. You know, I mean, you couldn't, Mike. You know, oh my goodness. And then she goes on to explain, and I won't go through this, we don't have a whole lot of time, and frankly, we've been doing this 35 years, and the spots on the moon still leave me scratching my head. Well, and much of paradise does. And the nice thing about it is, you kind of do it with a group of young fellow pilgrims, and we just slug it out, you know? And because we try to see clarity, and when you add 18 young lights, and, you know, and my aging light, you know, to the conversation, all of a sudden what happens is it starts to get a little brighter. And so she ends up essentially explaining that the reasons that there are spots on the moon has nothing to do with the physics of it. It has to do with the symbolism of the gradation of God's light. That God's light is distributed based on capacity, you know, that there's no, in paradise, it's a really interesting place because there's no real equality. You know, people are different according to their capacities and things that they are. So thus the moon is spotted because it captures the expression of God's, the light being distributed fully, but not always equally, if that makes sense. And the best I could come up with, you know, and Dante, he's fired up when he gets the explanation, because he understands it. We really don't, but he does, and so we're with him, and we're working it through, and he feels like he's been fed with living light, right? So like nutrition, you know, to feed on light. And then the best I could come up with, and I talked to a Dante scholar about this, and he kind of looked at me and said, this doesn't work. But I'm still kind of sticking with it, because it makes me feel like I'm closer. That the best line I've ever heard that I think we could have planned is when I moved to Baltimore and in 1980. And Mr. Schloeder at Gilman gave me a bumper sticker that said, if God's not a Tar Heel, why is the sky Carolina blue? And, you know, I mean, I came here from Iowa, you know, and I just thought, okay, maybe that bumper sticker captures a little bit about how and why there are spots on the moon. And I think, you know, you have to talk it through, right? I mean, it's not going to be really real easy. But so the pilgrim continues to move forward or move upward through paradise with Beatrice. And they go through Mercury is the second sphere. And the third sphere is the sphere of Venus. And the people who are, people don't live in the spheres. That they have left their heavenly seat and they've come down to, so Dante could learn. They're not really in the sphere. They sort of visit him. It's like the universe has essentially said to this poor struggling 35-year-old, we're all going to come down and help wake you up. You know, it's like the universe is, you know, not come at his beck and call, but come at his beck and agony, you know, and they come. And so, and then they disappear. And in the first three spheres, Dante is still inside the conical shadow of the earth. So the people that come to see him are people that are blessed, but still somewhat, that they are blessed, but they are lower in paradise. This is gradation because they had certain, they were defective in some way. You know, so they're ultimately, their decisions ultimately matter, even after forgiven and purged and cleansed. The blessed have different gradations of light. And a woman comes to see Dante in, it's described in Canto 9. And again, y'all can read it, and I'm going to give you a little taste of this, because time is just so flying by. But he meets a woman named Canisa, who was, I guess a way to describe her life was filled with, if you remember in To Kill a Mockingbird, cousin Francis that really Scout doesn't like very much, thinks it's the boringest child she's ever met. When he was born, he was born by way of a burst of friendliness on the part of his parents. That was how they described, right, from a burst of friendliness. And that's how he showed up. And Canisa in Canto 9 comes into Venus, and she had a life that was filled with amorous attachments, I guess. She had sort of a sequel of husbands and lovers and things, okay. Yet Dante has that woman be the person who is going to help clarify, that woman. I mean, this echoes of language that we'd, that's actually relevant, turns out. So I apologize, I sort of slipped into that. I didn't mean to do that. But Canisa, this woman, comes to, and Dante talks with her. And because what we spend our time in class trying to figure out in paradise, what exactly is the nature of blessedness? You know, like really, what is it? You know, I mean, heavenliness, you know, just exactly what does that mean? And we try to talk about it as these people have reached a kind of wholeness. But that doesn't end the conversation. It just starts it over again. And so she, Canisa, says that she was captured by this planet. That's the way she describes her love life, that she was captured by this planet. And then she says the following thing, and I personally, and, you know, I try to get our kids to think about the fact that this is, because we certainly don't want, obviously it's not confession, right, but we don't want, if we are defined by our worst mistakes, none of us have a shot, right? So, fortunately, we're not, and I think the universe Dante bears witness to is not. And Canisa says to Dante, I forgive myself gladly. That's what she says. So the nature of blessedness, she forgives herself gladly. And then she says, but vulgar minds wouldn't understand that. So think about this, right? We talked a little bit about class. I remember, you know, Monica Lewinsky, which I'm sure you remember that terrible situation happened. And what drove me most crazy about that situation, and there were certainly multiple layers of disappointment in that experience for all of us who may have had a certain kind of hope that was going to happen. But how hard people were on that young woman. You know, I mean, I read articles that said, oh, nobody want to marry her. However, you know, what kind of life she's going to live? Oh, my goodness. You know, and, you know, she's a 21-year-old kid, you know, who made a mistake. And certainly, you know, a fairly egregious one. You know, but welcome to the human race, and welcome to Canisa's world that says she forgives herself gladly. And people who are not willing to, because most of us are going to, lots of us want to say, she's letting herself off the hook. You know, she's not holding herself accountable. She's climbed Mount Purgatory. You know, she's climbed the mountain. You know, she's allowed to have her fullness of herself defined by the best of who she is, and not by her worst mistakes, if in fact there were mistakes. I'm not, you know, who are we to say? But it's one of my favorite parts of paradise because it challenges us, just like as Reverend Ware was talking about today. I love the fact that the kingdom is near. There's a really funky theological category that you all may have heard before that I really like, that I learned from Professor Don Moeller at St. Ambrose College in 1975. I took a course on the theology of St. John. And Dr. Moeller was just unbelievably thoughtful and challenging. It's this term, realized eschatology. You know, and realized eschatology essentially suggests that the judgment day, the end is now. The kingdom is here. You know, it's here. It may not be fully developed but it's here right now. And so I try to figure out what ends up sort of happening in relationship to getting to read and trying to be a better reader. And I'm trying to be a better reader each time I read a novel or something. But I am sort of aware that when I read, I am in the presence of the kingdom, if that makes sense. And not fully and stuff. And I was lucky enough to have another, Reverend Ware has a wonderful accent. And my friend Milton has a wonderful accent, and we have a wonderful headmaster at Gilman who has a wonderful Southern accent as well. And so I've been bombarded by, you know, accents of insight. So it's been kind of cool. I met a woman in England who was from Australia. I was at a Charles Dickens conference, and she had a great Australian accent. And she said that she went to visit a friend of hers who lives in Kansas. And the friend of her friends came to dinner, and the young woman said to her, "Gosh, I really love your accent." She said, "I wish I had an accent." You know, and she had to explain to her, "You do have, you know, you do have an accent. You know, come on. I mean, we all, what do we, you know, people are just incredible sometimes." She had a wonderful accent. It's Kansas, you know, it's we like it. But Mr. Smythe gave me a book, as a gift, just showed up at my home, a book that he had really liked, and it was called The Brothers K by James Duncan. And it's sort of a model off The Brothers Karamazov. And I got to a section in it where one of the characters is thinking about what the kingdom of heaven is like. And it's only 9 pages, and it took me almost an hour and a half to read. Because I decided, and I knew after the first paragraph, that this was something that I needed to just slow down and read every single word. Because it was biblically good. You know, I mean, I know there are theologically logistic problems with this, but I would have put this novel as like the 28th book of the New Testament. You know, and I know that would cause some ruffles historically, I think. But I can think of a number of books that I think would really be nice, ought to be canonical, but haven't quite made the cut yet. And I just finished a novel by James David Duncan again called The River Why, and it's all about fly fishing and sort of the spirituality of that. You remember at the beginning of A River Runs Through It, you know, there was little difference between our family, between religion and fly fishing. And so there's something about what I just finished, and then I come to get a chance to spend some time with you all, and all of a sudden it's about fishing. And I just finished that. And it's got a great cover. It's got a fish hook in the shape of a question. And that's what Reverend Ware said about, you know, not to find the meaning of life, but to let life question you. Remember, that was a fabulous line. So I'm taking notes, you know, sitting in the back of your church every Sunday. So it's been really pretty cool for me. So Dante goes into, in Canto 10, he moves through, it goes into the sun. And he meets, now things get really sort of almost Ohio State marching band-like. Because the spirits, the shades that come to talk to him about meaningful things take really meaningful shapes. You know, the people in the first three spheres didn't take a real meaningful shape. They just kind of came. And then when he gets into Canto 10, he gets into the sun, he's going to go past our source of light, right? So things are going to get pretty fairly meaningfully and fairly symbolically elaborate. And so he's crowned by 12 lights that go around his head, he and Beatrice. And he gets a chance to talk to the first one, and the first one, no surprise, and Dante's, because now he's in a sphere of intellectual light. So he gets a chance to talk to the really intellectual folks in the history of the church. And the first person he meets is Thomas Aquinas, you know, who certainly has, you know, Summa Theologica, you know, I mean, he wrote the big book. And, you know, he's the angelic doctor, I think Roman Catholicism refers to Thomas Aquinas as. So when Thomas Aquinas introduces himself to Dante, he says, "I am Thomas of Aquino." But then sorry, I get it wrong. He introduces the man next to him who was his teacher. He introduces his teacher first. And he introduces him as his brother and his teacher. And then he introduces himself. So blessedness sort of gets the order of the fact that none of us can do anything unless we stood on the shoulders of giants, right? And so here's Thomas Aquinas, who still, in Roman Catholic theology, I'm pretty sure, is still like the man, right? I mean, it's pretty hard, you know, you bounce off him pretty hard. I mean, he's not going down easy. Dante, and yet he acknowledges brother, teacher, me. That's sort of the sequence. And it's really, really cool. So now you're really in a part of paradise that's particularly challenging. So Dante leaves the sun with Beatrice. You know, she's helping him while he's talking to these people. She's always helping him. And as she gets brighter, he gets happier. No surprise. She's kind of his guide. I mean, I've had a really wonderfully unexpected grace, this year. And certainly not to embarrass this young man because he's such a wonderful young man, but, there's a young man who I got to coach on JV basketball when he was a Gilman. Got to have him as a fellow pilgrim on the road when he was a senior in high school. He grows up, gets married, they name their first daughter Beatrice, which was very nice, obviously. And then, he comes back to Gilman. He's the head of the history department, and he's my assistant basketball coach. So my life gets to go. That's why the Ptolemaic universe is so helpful, because I have this spherical connection with Mr. Matt Baum. You know, that it's come full circle. And, I mean, it just doesn't get much better than that. And who could have, expected that, right? I certainly couldn't. So it's cool. You get to sit on the bench with a former player, now colleague, now parent. And his son likes to take charging fouls. His son is 6. And so every time I see him, I go up to him and I say, "You ready?" And he starts smiling from ear to ear. And I set my hand on his chest. And I just kind of push him a little bit. And I ask him, "How's it feel?" This kid's in first grade. You know, and he's working on different words to respond each time. So he's gone from fabulous to awesome. You know, and that's his response. For every game, I get to just kind of push his chest. And so that's a little sappy, I understand. But it's good fortune is around us all the time if we look, I think. Can be. Not easy. So Beatrice and Dante go to into the sphere of Mars. And the sphere of Mars is where martyrs are celebrated. And Dante's great-great-grandfather, Cacciaguida, shows up. But the way that the people show up to Dante are in the shape of a Greek cross, right? And so they take these ornate shapes and, you know, crown him, and they show up in cross-like things and sort of like on a banner. Cacciaguida, who has been waiting for his great-great-grandson to come, like he is really fired up, to come and talk to his great-great-grandson. And it's the only family member in the entire story that Dante even mentions. But his great-great-grandfather, why he didn't choose, you know, dad, mom, you know, grandpa kind of thing. No, great-great-grandfather is the guy that comes to see him. And if you can imagine the triangle, right, Dante and Beatrice are here at the bottom, and then you got this triangle here, you got this part, quadrant of the cross, and Cacciaguida, you would think, because he's really eager, just like we would be, right, he comes, or you would think he would come, as fast as he could down the hypotenuse, right, you know, Pythagoras, you know, Euclid and Grace, right, I mean, you'd think he'd come straight down, but he doesn't. He stays along the radius of the cross and then comes to his great-great-grandson. So there are no shortcuts in paradise, right? So even there, he can't wait. You know, you can imagine how eager you would be. You know, he sees a child of yours that you haven't seen in a long time. And he goes to the center. We talk in our class, it's wonderful. John Denver, first day, right? Look to the center. Right, so what happens in Paradiso 15 through 18? He comes to the center first. Just like every good basketball player in every good basketball game is going to find a way to put his foot or her foot on the half-court line while warming up, right? You always touch the center first. And that's what Cacciaguida does. He goes to the center, and then he comes down, and they have a great conversation. And what Cacciaguida essentially tells Dante is Dante's afraid of what's happened to him, right? And Cacciaguida essentially tells him, you write down every single word. That's what he tells him to do. You write it, and also he predicts Dante's exile, and it's kind of sad for him. And Dante's afraid, you know, I've had all this stuff happen to me. I'm afraid it's going to upset people. And Cacciaguida says, you write down every word. And because if you don't, don't be a timid friend of truth. That's what he says. So Dante, and he tells him, listen, write it down, and if they don't like it, let them itch where it scratches, or let them scratch where it itches. That's what he says. And because he said eventually they're going to get it. So what's cool about this is Dante becomes somewhat prophetic in the classic biblical tradition of the prophets, whose job was to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable, right? And I think that's the poem, and Cacciaguida tells him that your poem, your story, if it makes people a little uncomfortable, if it challenges them, just like that woman we talked about last week who told truth to power, right? That poor woman who is celebrated on the terrace of the prideful, Cacciaguida. So then Dante, after he leaves Cacciaguida, sorry to go so fast here, I feel terrible. I mean, Dante goes much faster through paradise, but it's amazing how. So he finally gets to the sphere of divine justice, which, I mean, who doesn't want to be? Now we're going to get the answers, right? I mean, thank goodness. Justice, right? And the way the spirits show up to Dante, they show up in the planet of Jupiter, and they show up in a sky writing, literally. And the words say, love justice, you who rule the earth. And the last M turns into an eagle. So it's just so cool, right? The whole thing is skywriting, right? It's like going to Ocean City and watching where you're going to eat for dinner, you know? I mean, but it says, love justice, you who judge the earth. And all these people are rulers. And so the eagle talks with Dante. And Dante is just dying to know about justice because Virgil, right? Virgil got left out simply because of an accident of birth. And so the eagle starts to talk to him. And the eagle first tells him, it's almost like God in the 38th chapter of the book of Job, you know, tells Job to, I'm going to question you. You've been questioning me for the last 37 chapters. I'm going to ask you, who are you to question kind of thing? And that's what the eagle says to Dante. You're never going to understand this. It's deeper than the sea. Now, there is a bottom, but it's just harder for you to understand, which is really frustrating for pilgrims because you think, okay, listen, I've been working really hard here. I got some questions, and you're going to now tell me this is bigger than I am? I've already figured that part out. You know, please give me some answers. And the eagle doesn't give any answers. The eagle says, so you imagine a man born on the Indus River. He picks the Indus River. He talks about a geographical example. He doesn't even give us a chronological one. Right? And he says, imagine him never heard of Christ, you know, why is it fair that he's saved? And then he goes through the traditional Christian belief, you know, that, you know, you got to believe in Christ to be saved. But then he goes on to really chastise all the people who claim to love Christ but don't act like it. Right? So the eagle is really, 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 really firm and still kind of leaves Dante dangling. And finally you get to see the eye of the eagle. And in the eye of the eagle, David is the eyeball. And then there are five other lights that make up the eyebrow. And I'll let you read this to find out who they are. You're going to be stunned. Who gets to be in the eye, right? Because to be in the eye, you know, get to be, you know, what do you want to do? What do you want to be when you grow up? I want to be one of the eyebrows of the Eagle of Justice. You know, that would be a pretty good place to hang out. And the first one and the fifth one are pagans. And so paradise is not as sealed and locked as traditionally. Dante was both, you know, traditional and also pretty I don't use the word liberal, but progressive in terms of making people think about that. Even the people in paradise don't know all the people that are going to be saved, and they know everything, is what the eagle tells us. And you know what? After the eagle gets done talking, the last two lights, after they get explained, it is just so sweet. They start flashing. It's almost like they're winking. They wink at the pilgrim. You know, the universe doesn't think we belong here, kind of thing. It's a beautiful moment. And finally, Dante moves through, and he gets to the big light. And the big light is when he gets into sphere number 10, the Empyrean, he says he has reached the place, essentially, of full light. And he's having a heck of a time trying to describe it. But then when you get to heaven, what happens? And this is where really kind of the coolest thing, and I'm glad to sort of share this with you at the end. And the most important thing is kind of read it if you get a chance sometime. Beatrice is still with him, and he sees a river. And out of the river are these sparks. And Beatrice says to him, what you are seeing are merely shadowy prefaces of the truth. And in order to actually see things as they are, you have to bathe your eyes in the river of light. So Dante does. He sticks his face into this river and gets his eyes cleaned out with light. And it really is a kind of spiritual laser surgery, right? And I'm still pretty convinced that every time we read, we are putting our eyes into the river of light, you know, and cleansing, get a chance to cleanse our eyes, our pronoun eyes as well as our actual eyes. And he comes out, right? He enters the light just like an eager baby going at his mother's breast. So Dante describes it. So it's a pretty hungry adult who is at his most mature and smartest when he's acting like an infant. You know, it's just like we love children's music still, because even at our ages, right? Because it taps into that part of us that really matters. And the river turns into a circle, and it's not straight, it's not linear, it's circular, and it's angels that are flashing out of the river, and they are going to a heavenly rose. And paradise is like an amphitheater in Dante's poem. He describes it as a heavenly rose. And I had a wonderful student back in 1994. Some of you may know her name is Kate Spees Guyton, if anybody know Kate. And the year after, you know, lucky enough to, you know, travel to paradise with her and some other fellow pilgrims. She was in a class with the sports writer for the Sun, Childs Walker. If anybody's read anything by Childs Walker, he's wonderful. Class of 94. And about 8 months after that, I received this gift from her. And I know you all can't see it from where you are, and you're more than welcome to come up and take a look, but I didn't have a thing, of a rose she grew in her backyard. And it's a climbing rose, which is kind of appropriate. And what the coolest thing about this, besides her thoughtfulness, and I have it in my classroom all the time, so I get reminded of her on a daily basis. Now she's subbing in Gilman's lower school. She's got two kids, you know, which is such a cool thing, you know, to walk through the lower school and run into the girl who grew the rose, you know. And if you look at this really closely, there's more than one rose here. And I didn't notice it for like 5 years. And then I started looking at it again, and I noticed that there are a number of roses in the process of opening. So it's more perfect than even Kate realized, because it was certainly very nice and thoughtful of her. But the challenge to grow into seeing more clearly is always an ongoing sort of challenge. And then Dante finally gets a glimpse of God, and it flashes at him, and he sees these three concentric circles, and he gets a glimpse of the face of Jesus in the second one, and then just a flash, and it's over, and he says, I was conquered. And then he goes on to say that now He turns it over to the love that moves the sun and the other stars. And that's how the story ends. And something we did with our kids the last yesterday, which was really a very nice evening. So it was a nice evening for me. So the kid, here's what the kids do for their final exam. And you might want to do this sometime, too. You know, I mean, maybe if it appeals to you. We try to make sure that every good experience begins and ends in music. So their assignment is to listen to three pieces of music, take really thorough marginalia notes on the music, like what part of the music touches them. And the three songs that they listen to, and then I have something for you, so you're not, don't feel like you're, hopefully, don't feel like you're just left with nothing. And you can take it. I'll explain to this in a second. But kids take three marginalia notes, really thorough, and three songs. I Finally Found It, Sandy by Harry Chapin. Follow That Road by Ann Hills. And The Kid by David Wilcox. And so it was, again, my opportunity to feed folk music to these children who just, you know, are parched for folk music. So, and these kids have been, particularly, it's been true of my Dante students for years, and this group in particular has been, we have class every other day, and they've just been an absolute every other day delight. Every other day. I mean, they come, they do their homework. I really can't think of a day where we didn't have a discussion because somebody hadn't done it. I mean, they've been pretty locked in. If you take it, they've just been a real treat. And so here's what they do. They then have to pick their favorite song of the three, and they have to imagine that Dante has, at the end of his trip, and at the end of having written the story, right? Because he essentially takes it twice. He goes from hell to paradise, and then he writes about his experience from hell to paradise. And as you probably know, that sometimes when you write down your memories, it can trigger almost as intense experience as if it was actually going on immediately. And what they have to do is they have to imagine Dante sitting in an easy chair, puts his headphones on, 1321 Ravenna, and Dante's listening to the song that they chose. And then they have to sit down for exactly 1 hour, and they have to write how that song would have helped Dante, sitting in his chair, looking back at his whole experience, and feel like the journey was worthwhile. And so, last night, most of them, some of them couldn't come. We ordered Indian food. They came to my apartment, which is not particularly big, but it's certainly enough room for 13 young pilgrims and one older one. And we had dinner, and then we spent an hour and 10 minutes going around my living room talking about how they thought the music connected to Dante's experience. And that's their final exam. I mean, they turn it in, and they really did. They just some really, really good, thoughtful work. I mean, it was just, you know, you just kind of sit. Like we talked about on the first day, these kids don't realize, and they will when they're 50. They don't realize it now, but they say things that are worth paying really close attention to. And this group has been a particularly striking and enjoyable group to hang out with. So, and I get to every year, and so maybe another one next year. So, you know, it's just, we don't really go fishing, but the door is open to the cabin, the Dante cabin, I guess. But here's what I have for you all. And something we did back in 2006 was because I decided to, it's my plan, you know, I get to pick, that the kids would have to listen to four pieces of Harry Chapin's music, and they would have to write an essay four times a semester on how this piece of music would have benefited a character in Dante's poem. And 2006 just had a group of kids that just kind of went nuts over Harry Chapin. Now, that doesn't surprise me, because I get that. But I was pleasantly surprised. You know, like, they'd come to my office, and they would say, we were listening to Harry in the senior room, and can we talk about him? You mean, you know, I can't imagine a situation in my life where I said no to that. You know, I mean, I really can't, you know. So what we did is I decided I took eight of the best pieces and created a Dante Harry Chapin anthology, a book. And it's got the lyrics, it's got an introduction, it's got a table of contents, it's got everything. What it doesn't have, at the back, the originals, it had a CD of the four songs in the back. And so with the original printing, first printing, self-printing, because we sold these. They were, half the money went to the Dante Society of America and half the money went to the Harry Chapin Foundation. And we sold about 100 copies, even had to do a second printing. But I have some of these here for you for free. But what's better, I think, or I don't know if better, but I only made a few copies because what I have for you is my relationship with technology has been fairly, it's been a very fickle relationship and not always particularly pleasant. But because we have some wizards at Gilman and I decided to take a chance, here's what I have for you. And I hope it's of value. If it's not, then obviously you should, but I hope so. But what it says on here is, please log on to the above link or scan this space-age 21st century, oh my goodness, what a world, QR code pictured below, and you will find a repository of material focused on what we discussed these last few weeks regarding Dante's challenge to educate the eye, John Ciardi. I hope you find the resources thoughtful and interesting. If you have any questions, quests I'm on, Sam Keen, or thoughts, please write to my email address, dchristian@gilman.edu. I've cherished the unexpected grace of being able to share some Dante time with you, like each wonderful opportunity that has come my way, thanks to Dante's potent and poignant story, I will always remember these three special mornings. Thank you. So here's what you have. There's a quotation from Dante in Paradise on the back. It's double-sided. And if you go to the table of contents, it will give you the following things. And you can log on. So you can have everything that we talked about electronically through that link. You get Alex Bauman's paper. You get Ann Hill's Follow That Road on an MP3 file. You get Ann Hill's lyrics. You get the Brandenburg Concerto. You get Josh Groban singing Bring Him Home from Les Miserables. And then you get the lyrics. You get All My Life's a Circle, a Harry Chapin and Dante Anthology PDF. So you have the entire book available electronically for you. So you can print it out and read it, or read it on your screen if that's a way you like to do it. Mac Bailey's Don't Look Down, that's the song we sing when we were climbing Mount Purgatory, and then the lyrics. We do these phone interviews, right? And we did one interview with a woman from the University of Oregon who wrote a great paper called Love for Beatrice, Transcending Contradiction in the Paradiso. So there's a copy of that essay that you, in this link. And then Regina Saki's phone interview. You can listen to our conversation with her. The Arkansas class was not with this one, but you can listen to our phone interview with her. She's a really wonderful Dante scholar. There's the article that some of you picked up back in 1994 that some kids wrote that was published. That whole article is available on the link. Kate Spees even has, Kate Spees Guyton. Has an article that she wrote is in there. David Wilcox singing the kid MP3, Tom Chapin's Pass the Music On music, and the lyrics. And then also I have for you a printed out copy of the lyrics so that you would sort of have them. So if you have that phone thing that can scan that code, when I went into the tech folks the other day and said, here's what I'd like to do so these folks can walk away with something, a substance, he said, we can create one of these. I said, no way. You know, come on. I mean, that's it. You know, I mean, that's what they do when I buy orange juice. You know, how you do that? So they created this thing, and they showed it. They put their phone up to it and had that app, and they opened up the entire link within, like, 4 seconds. And so all the things that we talked about are available to you. All you got to do is just come up and take one of these before you leave and just log on to that link. It's http://tiny.cc/Dante_@Redeemer. So you all have your own link. So I cannot thank you enough for what a treat this has been for me. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. So does anybody have any questions at all? I mean, you're more than welcome to, I'll do my best to, if anybody has. Yes, sir. How are you? It is very interesting. That's very well. Yeah.
Does that have an implication for realized eschatology and perhaps ecumenicism at the end of time?
That's beautiful. I mean, that's very well said. Thank you. Yeah, and then so what you get to do, right, is so now you have the title to the article you're going to write. And then you can just, start typing. Because that's wonderful. I think that's, and if anything, and if you listen to the last words that Beatrice gets in the story to the pilgrim, she doesn't say, way to go, attaboy. She starts talking about Italian politics and about how, Henry VII, didn't work. Those are the last words out of her mouth. She's Meryl Streep. Right? I mean, she's got thoughts about things that are bigger than Dante. And so, but then when he says goodbye to her, it is the most touching moment. He thanks her. She goes back to her seat because she has to leave. And he thanks her for putting her footprints into hell for his salvation. And he just essentially says, when I get back here, I hope that I've done you proud, essentially. That's kind of my translation of it. But and then she looks at him and smiles and appreciates the recognition, and then turns back to the eternal fountain, which is the last line of A Grief Observed. Poesi all'eterna fontana. Right? So right at the end, I mean, it's wonderful. But yeah, that's a very good point. I think the poem is so open to, in my Father's house there are many mansions, and, mansions, subdivisions, countries. I mean, it's a pretty big space. The best thing, and what you all did, when Reverend Ware's talking, you all are clearly fortunate enough to have a song we play on day one also is called Angels by Terra Nova. And some folk music folks, they still make music in Chestertown, New York, or Chestertown, Maryland. And they say, stay on your lookout for someone bearing light. I'm going blank, I apologize. But my favorite angels, don't you go thinking that they're not around, because my favorite angels are those with 2 feet on the ground. And what I've been so struck by, just coming here, is with Reverend Ware and Reverend Stewart, and I can't pronounce Christina's last name. I apologize to that. She wrote a wonderful thing on prepositions. I mean, you all have the opportunity. It's just so obvious to me. Being certainly brand new to here, that you have people that are in the pastoral realm of your church who are just rolling back stones every Sunday away from the tomb. The text tells us an angel came down and did it, but you have folks here that are doing it for you every day, or every Sunday, and probably every day. And maybe that's our challenge, right? To, if we can roll back, open some space, so Messiah's can come out and we can come out with him. It would be a pretty nice thing. Any other questions? I know it's been a long time. Thank you again very, very much. Very much.